Have you ever, just stared at the hour hand on an analog clock?
Oh, yeah, it's totally agonizing.
Right, you sit there, focusing on it for what feels like an eternity, and your eyes will absolutely swear to you that it is perfectly stationary. Like you never actually see it move.
No, you don't. It creates this perfect illusion of stability.
Exactly. But if you walk away, make a cup of coffee, come back 10 minutes later, it's in a completely different place. It is never still, despite what your perception is telling you right in that moment.
We trust it because it feels reliable, but we are completely blind to that gradual drift happening right in front of us.
Yeah. So, welcome to today's deep dive. Because it turns out that hour hand illusion is actually the perfect metaphor for how our brains handle our deepest convictions, especially when there's money on the line or, professional reputations are at stake.
And the underlying tension we're unpacking today is that the human brain's default setting is, well, it's not objective truth. Its default setting is self-preservation and narrative smoothing.
Right. Today, we were pulling from a really fascinating piece of source material. It's chapter 7 of the AI Native Investor curriculum. And it is titled, Write It Down or It Isn't a Thesis.
Which is a bold title.
It is. And our mission for this deep dive is to explore why, neurologically, we're just wired to be terrible at holding on to investment beliefs. And we're going to look at how creating a rigorously written, AI stress-tested framework, like a real thesis, is basically the ultimate hack for accountable decision-making.
Yeah, and this matters for you listening, because whether you're managing a massive portfolio or just making large strategic bets at your company, you have to diagnose why your own internal sense of conviction is fundamentally flawed. We have to draw a hard, definitive line between a loosely held belief and a formal thesis.
Because they're structurally entirely different.
Entirely.
The text actually illustrates this beautifully with the Tesla in 2019 retail investor phenomenon, which is just wild to think back on.
Oh man, that was a crazy time.
Right. So picture the landscape in April 2020. You have thousands of retail investors who suddenly claim they, always believed in Tesla. They look back at the 2019 drawdowns, the massive crashes, the relentless media skepticism, and they state with complete confidence, I always had a thesis. I knew EVs would dominate, and I knew Tesla was the undeniable leader.
Yeah, and they felt incredibly vindicated when the stock went up, what, roughly 700% that year?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Massive. But here's the thing, the historical reality completely disconnects from their memory of it.
What's fascinating here is the neurology behind it. In 2019, many of those investors did not actually have a thesis. They simply had an open position in their brokerage account. The so-called thesis they talked about in 2020 was retroactively assembled.
Right, to match the positive outcome.
Exactly. It was a narrative just, stitched together by their own memory after the fact.
Okay, but let's unpack this for a second. If I look at the legends of Wall Street, the defining trait they all seem to preach is conviction. Holding on when everyone else is panicking. So, isn't holding through the turbulence exactly what we are supposed to do?
Well, the catch there lies in how that conviction is stored in your brain. Human memory is reconstructive, not archival.
What does that mean exactly?
So when you recall a file on a computer, you are opening an exact preserved copy of that data. But when a human recalls a memory or, a past belief, the brain pulls it up, subtly modifies it to be consistent with whatever new information you have today, and then saves over the original version.
Oh, wow. So you don't even know you're changing it.
Right. A belief is essentially a living organism built to accommodate reality as it changes. A thesis, on the other hand, is built to confront reality.
I really like that distinction. It makes me think of an unwritten belief as a mood ring. It just quietly changes color based on whatever the current temperature of the market is, keeping you perfectly comfortable without you ever noticing the shift. Whereas a true thesis is like a locked safe with a highly specific combination.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
The combination doesn't change just because the weather outside changed.
Taking that mood ring analogy a step further, the text outlines the actual mechanics of belief drift to show how dangerous this is. So imagine you buy a company's stock because you believe a new product launch is going to capture 15% market share over the next 3 years.
Okay, specific target, 15%.
Right. That is your initial reason for buying.
Okay.
But 9 months later, the company announces the product is severely delayed. The stock instantly drops 20%.
And naturally, panic sets in.
But it doesn't, because your brain protects you. You tell yourself, well, supply chain delays happen to everyone. The core premise is intact.
Oh, is it?
Then, 12 months later, the product finally launches, but it struggles. It only captures 4% market share.
Which is a massive failure compared to that original 15% target.
But the investor doesn't experience it as a failure. They look at the 4% and tell themselves, well, adoption takes time, the competitive landscape shifted, and really, I mean, my conviction was always about the company's long-term platform potential anyway.
The hour hand moved.
Exactly.
The rationale mutated 3 separate times just to protect the investor's ego.
Mm.
The 15% target completely failed, but because it wasn't locked down in writing, they just drifted into a new justification to avoid admitting they were wrong.
And this specific vulnerability is exactly why Warren Buffett notoriously requires anyone proposing an investment to him to write a short essay.
Wait, really? An essay?
Yeah. He wants a written argument explaining exactly why a business is worth buying at its current price. He doesn't just want to look at a complex spreadsheet model. Because writing forces a biological bottleneck, it demands a level of structural clarity and commitment that simply holding a fuzzy belief in your head just does not require.
So how do we build that lock safe? The source material breaks down the architecture of a written thesis into 6 mandatory elements. And these are designed to leave absolutely no room for your brain to hide.
Right.
So the first question you have to answer is, why now? This is the catalyst.
Yeah, the catalyst forces you to articulate why this specific investment makes sense today rather than 6 months ago or, you know, 6 months from now. Are you expecting margin expansion? Like the company found a way to widen the gap between costs and prices, or maybe you're betting on a sentiment reset because the market wildly overreacted to some short-term bad news.
You need a defined mechanism.
Exactly.
Though the text does offer a caveat here for long-duration bets. Like if we look at Buffett's legendary 1988 purchase of Coca-Cola, there wasn't a traditional immediate catalyst, like a new product launch.
Right. For decades-long compounding bets, the catalyst can occasionally be the explicit absence of a short-term catalyst. The argument becomes, you know, the market is currently pricing this company for permanent stagnation, and I believe it will simply continue to steadily compound cash flow.
But you still have to state that in advance.
Yes. Simply saying, I like the stock doesn't qualify.
Right. But a catalyst doesn't matter if the business itself is fragile. Which brings us to the second element, the moat. Why won't this company's profits just be competed away by someone smarter or better funded?
We're talking network effects, high switching costs, scale advantages, or intangibles like patents.
And the crucial factor here is being brutally honest about the durability of that moat. Like, a software feature that a well-funded competitor can reverse engineer in 8 months is entirely different from a legally binding regulatory monopoly.
Totally different. And a strong moat also relies heavily on the people managing it, which is the third element, management.
Right. Can these specific individuals execute the strategy?
And the framework is rigid here. This cannot be based on vibes or charisma during an earnings call.
No vibes allowed.
Got it. None. You have to document evidence-based metrics. Has the executive team been using their own money to buy shares on the open market? Does their comp structure reward them for generating true free cash flow, or are they just incentivized to boost short-term revenue growth at the expense of profitability?
Yeah, but even incredible management with a wide moat is a bad bet if you pay way too much for it. So element 4 is the valuation frame, and this isn't about running an incredibly dense 50-tab Excel model to find some supposed true value.
No, not at all.
It's about articulating the gap between the story the broader market is currently telling and the story your thesis implies. Mm. What specific future are you actually paying for? Because if you are paying a massive premium, you are paying for the right to be different from the consensus.
Yeah.
You have to define what that difference is.
And valuations naturally fluctuate, which introduces the 5th element. And this is arguably the most critical defensive mechanism in the entire safe. Kill criteria.
Yes.
You have to define the specific observable conditions in the real world that would force you to conclude your thesis is broken. Like, if this social media platform's monthly active user growth declines for 3 consecutive quarters, I must reassess the position.
Okay, let me push back on this concept a bit. How is a kill criterion fundamentally any different from just a standard stop loss order? If I set a rule that says, you know, sell if the stock drops 15%, isn't that doing the exact same job of protecting my downside?
They operate on entirely different mechanical principles. A stop loss is tied exclusively to the stock's price. If the broader market suffers a macro panic and everything drops 30%, your stop loss triggers and you are cashed out. Even if every fundamental element of the company's actual business is performing perfectly.
That makes sense.
Conversely, a stock could rise 50% purely on speculative retail hype, which completely masks the fact that the underlying business is actually deteriorating.
Okay, I see the disconnect. So a standard stop loss is basically like bailing out of a moving car just because you notice the speedometer is going faster or slower than you expected.
Right.
But a kill criterion is like pulling the car over to the side of the road because the engine is making a grinding noise.
No.
Even if the car is technically still rolling forward at a good speed.
I love that car analogy. Pulling over to check the engine prevents a catastrophic breakdown, while bailing out over a pothole just leaves you stranded on the highway. Kill criteria tie your decision-making directly to the validity of the thesis, not to the emotional roller coaster of price movement.
And it triggers a reassessment, not an automatic sell, right?
Exactly. It forces a deliberate, conscious re-examination of the facts. It breaks that automatic panic response.
Which flows perfectly into the final structural piece, element 6, time horizon. When do you evaluate the ultimate outcome of the bet, totally independent of what the stock price is doing today? The text connects this to investor Howard Marks, who points out that focusing on short horizons drastically amplifies meaningless noise.
Yeah, executing a highly disciplined 12-month thesis is infinitely more valuable than writing a sprawling 10-year thesis that you panic abandon after just 6 months because of a bad quarterly report.
So, to summarize the architecture, catalyst, moat, management, valuation frame, kill criteria, and time horizon. When all six of those are locked down in a physical document, you no longer have a belief. You have a thesis.
But having a locked safe doesn't guarantee the contents are secure until you actually try to break into it.
Yes. Here is where the source material introduces an incredibly modern twist. This is where the physical act of writing, combined with artificial intelligence, becomes an absolute superpower.
Because the physical writing is step one. It acts as a psychological commitment device. Think about the myth of Odysseus having his crew tie him to the mast of his ship so he wouldn't steer them into the rocks when he heard the siren's song.
Such a great comparison.
Writing your thesis down restricts your future choices. It is a mechanism to prevent you from acting against your own long-term interests when the sirens of market volatility start screaming.
The legendary value investor Benjamin Graham always talked about the margin of safety, the idea that you have to know precisely where your own analysis might fail. But as the text bluntly points out, human beings are neurologically terrible at finding the flaws in our own brilliant ideas.
We love our ideas too much to destroy them.
We really do. Which is why the framework introduces the AI agent, but with a highly specific prompt. You don't ask the AI for general feedback. You instruct it to act as a ruthless forensic short seller.
Like Muddy Waters or Hindenburg Research.
Yeah, exactly. Organizations whose entire business model relies on finding the catastrophic flaws in publicly traded companies and betting against them. You hand the AI your six-element document and basically say, you are a specialized short seller holding a massive position against me. Give me the three strongest, most devastatingly specific arguments for why this exact thesis will collapse.
It's aggressive.
It is. Now, I have to be a little skeptical about the technology's capability here. Isn't AI actually sophisticated enough to find the real devastating idiosyncratic risks of a complex business model?
Yeah.
Or is it just going to regurgitate, you know, generic corporate risk factors? Like if it just says, well, there are looming macroeconomic headwinds and the competitive landscape is fierce, that's completely useless.
And the text addresses this limitation directly. The true value of the AI in this process is not its imagination. It is not going to predict a completely unpredictable black swan event. Its superpower is its unflinching thoroughness.
Meaning what exactly?
Well, human analysts suffer from massive blind spots because we experience actual, measurable psychological discomfort when we are forced to explore the possibility that we are wrong. Cognitive dissonance physically hurts.
Right.
The AI experiences zero cognitive dissonance. It will systematically test every single known failure mode against every single sentence of your thesis. It acts as an exhaustively thorough checklist that just doesn't care about your feelings.
That's brilliant. So the AI attacks the thesis. What comes next is an attack and iterate loop. You take the AI's best arguments, and for each one, you are forced to take one of three actions. Concede, counter, or dismiss.
Yeah. You concede if the AI actually uncovered a legitimate flaw in your logic, which means you have to physically alter your thesis or reduce the size of the position you plan to take.
Okay.
You counter if you have specific data-backed evidence that mitigates the AI's concern. And importantly, you must write that counter-argument directly into the document. Or finally, you dismiss the attack entirely. But only if you can prove the AI misunderstood the mechanics of the business or relied on outdated data.
And then you run the loop again. You feed the newly fortified thesis back to the AI and demand another round of attacks. You repeat this iteration until the AI is basically forced to grasp at absurd straws, like suggesting, alien contact might disrupt supply chains.
Right. Once the attacks become implausible, your safe is finally locked. The thesis is formalized. The stress test is complete. The capital is deployed.
But the real world refuses to stay still. Mm-hmm. It's chaotic. Companies release earnings, regulatory environments shift, unexpected pandemics shut down global trade. How do you adapt this beautifully rigid, AI-tested document to new incoming data without slipping right back into that self-serving mood ring memory drift?
This is where we run headfirst into the structural bugs of the human brain. To combat those bugs, the framework relies on strict versioning. The cardinal rule is you create new, labeled versions of your thesis. You never, ever patch the old one.
The text is adamant that patching is dangerous. It uses this great philosophical concept to explain why. The ship of Theseus.
Oh, I love this part.
So, the ancient thought experiment asks, if you replace every single rotting wooden plank on a ship over a period of 10 years, is it still fundamentally the same ship?
Right.
Translated to investing. If you quietly update the catalyst, and then 3 months later you tweak the moat, and then you quietly extend the time horizon by a year, at what point are you just holding a completely different investment entirely while pretending you planned it all along?
The insidious nature of patching is that it feels like reasonable, responsible maintenance in the moment, but it guarantees narrative drift over time. This is why formal versioning is required. Version 1.0 is the original. Version 1.1 reflects minor data updates. Version 2.0 is issued only for major fundamental shifts.
And to enforce this, the system mandates a strict 90-day review cycle. Every quarter, typically aligned with corporate earnings reports, you must make a binary choice to reaffirm, revise, or retire the thesis.
Now, this 90-day rhythm might sound like bureaucratic busy work, but the text makes it clear that it is a targeted defense mechanism against the most destructive psychological biases in finance. Let's break down how this works in practice, starting with confirmation bias.
Which is the brain's tendency to filter all new information so that it magically supports whatever you already believe.
Yes. For example, if a company reports completely flat revenue, a bullish investor looks at that and says, wow, look at that resilience in a tough macro environment. Meanwhile, a bearish investor looks at the exact same flat number and says, proof of stalling growth, the end is near.
But the written thesis neutralizes that confirmation bias because it forces you to confront the number you committed to before the earnings were released. Like if your version 1.0 thesis explicitly stated, I expect 12% revenue growth driven by the new product, and the result comes in flat, the document removes your ability to spin the narrative. It forces you to acknowledge a miss.
Exactly. Then we have loss aversion, specifically a concept behavioral finance researchers call the disposition effect. This was studied heavily by Terence O'Dean. The mechanism here is wild. Investors routinely sell their winning stocks way too early because clicking sell triggers a rush of dopamine. You locked in a gain, you prove you were smart.
Right.
But those same investors will hold on to a stock that has cratered 40% because officially selling it forces them to experience the psychological pain of admitting a failure. They hold losers to delay the pain.
And your kill criteria combat this disposition effect directly. By writing down the exact conditions for failure in advance, your decision to sell is tethered to the objective validity of the business model, not the red or green color of the numbers flashing in your brokerage app today.
The system also addresses the sunk cost fallacy. This is the trap where you refuse to abandon an investment simply because you've already poured weeks of research into reading 10Ks and listening to earnings calls. You feel like you can't just walk away from that effort.
And finally, there's the narrative fallacy, which is a concept popularized by Nassim Taleb. This is our tendency to mistake hindsight for inevitability. People look back at Tesla and say, of course they succeeded, the transition to EVs was inevitable. But if you look at the actual narrative in 2017, the consensus was that they would go bankrupt because they couldn't manufacture at scale.
Freezing your narrative in a dated timestamp document completely shatters the illusion that you knew it all along. And during this 90-day review cycle, the AI agent shifts its role from being an aggressive short seller to serving as your objective external memory.
External memory. Tell me how that works practically.
Well, 3 months is a long time. When the new quarterly earnings report drops, you will have inevitably forgotten the precise nuances of your original kill criteria. So you prompt your AI differently. You upload the new earnings data and say, read my version 1.0 thesis back to me. Do not summarize it. Now, systematically compare the new earnings data against the specific metrics I established in my six elements.
But the text screams this warning from the rooftops. During this phase, the AI should remind it must never decide.
That is a non-negotiable distinction. The AI is performing analytical grunt work. It is perfectly suited to cross-reference a 50-page earnings transcript against your one-page thesis and flag discrepancies. But the AI does not understand your personal risk tolerance, your tax implications, or, you know, the broader context of your life.
Right.
If you ask an AI, should I hold or sell, it will simply calculate a probability based on the very market consensus you are actively trying to outperform. The human must retain the final judgment.
Do the heavy lifting, keep the judgment. I like that. So we've outlined this incredibly robust, almost militaristic accountability system.
Sure.
Six defined elements, AI red teaming, strict 90-day review cycles, formal version control. It raises a very practical question. Is it actually possible to have too much discipline?
The source material is refreshingly honest about the real-world costs of this level of formalization. The primary danger is rigidity. Slavishly adhering to a hyper-specific kill criterion during an unprecedented, unpredictable macro event like the sudden outbreak of a global pandemic isn't demonstrating discipline, it is demonstrating rigidity.
Sometimes criteria need to be manually overridden by human judgment.
Exactly, but the rule is that you must formally document why you are making the exception in version 1.1.
Another massive trap is analysis paralysis. It is very easy to weaponize this framework as an elaborate procrastination tool. Mm-hmm. Like you can run endless AI red team loops because you are terrified of actually putting money on the line.
Mm-hmm.
A flawless, risk-free thesis just does not exist.
And arguably the most common hurdle is formality fatigue. Conducting a rigorous 90-day, hour-long review for 10 or 15 different individual stock positions requires a massive commitment of time and cognitive energy.
Which brings up a question I know you listening are probably asking right now. Does the average person really need to run a 90-day AI red team loop for every single broad S&P 500 index fund sitting quietly in their retirement account?
Thankfully, no. The text specifies that this intensive framework is designed strictly for concentrated individual bets where you are actively choosing to differ from the market's consensus. Broad index funds that you intend to hold for three decades do not require a complex six-element thesis.
Because your rationale is already built in.
Right. Your rationale for an index fund is simply, I believe in the long-term compounding of global equities and I am highly diversified. You reserve this heavy lifting for the individual bets where your ego is claiming that you know something the rest of the market does not.
Okay, that is incredibly relieving. So bringing all of these mechanics and analogies together, what is the ultimate takeaway of this curriculum? It seems the true value of writing all this down isn't actually about proving to the market that you are a genius.
No, it has nothing to do with external validation. The true value is creating unbreakable accountability to your past self. You are answering to the version of you who made the decision, using only the information available before the outcome arrived to reshape your memory.
That's powerful.
The investors who implement this aren't necessarily smarter or better at predicting the future. They are simply forced to be more honest with themselves, more consistently, over a longer period of time, and over a decade, the compound interest on that kind of honesty is staggering.
I want to leave you with a final lingering thought to explore on your own after this deep dive ends. We have spent this entire conversation dissecting how effortlessly our brains rewrite our past beliefs to protect our egos when it comes to money. But where else in your life is the hour hand moving without you noticing?
Oh, that's a great question.
Think about your career trajectory. Think about your long-term relationships. Think about your personal definitions of success. Where are you silently mutating your original theses in life, moving the goalposts just to avoid the profound discomfort of admitting that you might have been wrong?
It is a sobering reflection. Because if you refuse to write down your parameters for success or failure, your brain will happily rewrite the rules of the game so that you never have to feel like you lost.
It is the hour hand on the clock. You never see it moving. But it is never, ever still. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.